Greetings. You are listening to Writers on Writing, a show about the art, craft, and business of writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Hannah Sword. Daughter of the late poet Robert Sword, Hannah is the award-winning author of her debut memoir, Strip. Hannah Sword has appeared on NBC California Live, C-SPAN, Book TV, dozens of podcasts, panels, and has essays published in the Los Angeles Times, Huffington Post, Arts and Letters, etc. Hannah lives in Los Angeles, where she's working on her next book. To find out more, visit hannahsword.com. On the show, we talked about voice, what to do about family members who may be concerned with what you've written, short chapters, tools, getting personal, and much more. And now for my talk with Hannah Sword. So Hannah, I am so happy to talk to you about your memoir, Strip. Before we get into it, though, I would love to hear how you came to writing.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you so much for having me on. I know how long this podcast has been, over a couple decades. So to be invited on, I'm just honored. How it came to writing, really, I was born into it. My father was a poet, and it's my earliest memory is being on his back at poetry readings as a baby. And I mean, I don't remember that, but the pictures bring me back to that. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember when I first had a journal, but I do remember mimicking him. He was always writing, even at dinner, up until before he passed. And I was like, Dad, that's so rude. We're at dinner. put it away. So, as long as I can remember as far as coming to it as professionally, that took a very, very long time. However, not that it was professional, but after the book came out, a high school teacher a few months ago reached out to me and she said, oh, do you remember when I submitted your piece to the newspaper and you won? I'm like, I have no memory of that. Like, I don't have none. But so writing's my earliest memory.
Did you keep a journal or a diary as a kid?
I did. Yes. And I still have some of them. And it kept me company. And it was just what I was drawn to do.
So when you started writing Strip, or as you were writing Strip, did you refer back to the diary or the journal? Was it useful?
It is interesting because I went back to 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Some of the scenes that I really didn't want to write, I had, so it could bring me back. Mm-hmm. And some of the chapters even are word for word from that period. I think the journals, excuse me, I didn't go back to the earliest ones. However, I think even by writing them then, mm-hmm. it imprinted something within me.
Yeah. Yeah, just the act of writing something down, I think. I find even making lists, making lists makes me remember what I plan to do, right? Just because I wrote it down, even if I don't look.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And pictures helped, and also my father's poetry helped. Mm-hmm. Let me go back to remember as well. Mm-hmm. And I didn't actually come across some of my very, very earliest journals until after the book was published. And I was going through some things at my family home, and I went, oh.
Well, because I think what I hear from especially from students who are working on memoir, is, you know, how can I write that when I don't remember? Or how can I write dialogue if I don't remember? If I didn't write it down, you know, if I don't have something to draw from. So how did you deal with that? I mean, what I tell them is, you know, what would you have said? What would they have said? You're not going to put words in their mouth that they would have never said, but you have to reconstruct it to some degree. So Absolutely. How did you deal with that in Strip?
It's a very long process. I started writing it backwards. So I wasn't doing childhood. So I wasn't going through that. So I was working more with earlier memories and years earlier. I mean, not earlier in my age. By the time I got to childhood, I wrote all of the first draft without even knowing it was a draft, pen to paper. I'm still a pen to paper person. It's all how I write everything. And really bringing myself back into that time, into that place, finding the voice helped me remember, or helped me not remember the exact words, but the feeling. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important part to me, right? Is what's the feeling that's evoking within myself? A lot of it didn't come into the book, but within that, there's these gems of the dialogue that for me would ring true. I'm like, that sounds true to me. And when it didn't, I had a great mentor that said, this doesn't. Mm-hmm. She was.
Are you talking about Jill Shari Robinson?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
Because I found it so interesting that she was or is your mentor, because I remember reading, was it her first book, Bedtime Story? And yeah. I might have read Perdido too when these books came out so long ago. And I just remember loving them. Talk about that. Talk about finding her and working with a mentor.
I love that you've read her books. Yeah. And in fact, a couple of years ago, the Washington Post even brought Bedtime Stories back into like one of the all-time love books in mm-hmm. with their list, which was really exciting to see it come back. I found her at a library. I was early in my sobriety, and throughout my addiction, I was writing, but not really. It haunted me every day, because it was like I knew within myself it was what I needed to be doing, and I wasn't. And that's a painful place to be. Mm-hmm. Very painful, you know. And so it was early on in sobriety, and I knew I wanted to get back to the page. Simply write again, which wasn't so simple. And I was somewhere, and this woman was sharing about whatever I was. So, and she said something about getting into a car accident, and I in a parking lot. And I said, "What?" A writing group. And I went up to her and I said, "What's the writing group?" she told me. I was at this Hollywood library, and the following week I went to it. An eclectic group of people, a lot of homeless people in there. Sleeping on the side, and here she was, Jill Shari Robinson. I didn't know who she was, but I thought, here's this older woman. She was maybe in her late 70s at the time, wearing a bolo tie and just a cool older woman. And I read, and she came up to me afterwards, and she said, "I want you to come to my home. I have a writing group." And so I started going to her writing group twice a week, and we started working together. She took me under her wing. It's her way of giving back. She had a lifetime grant that she got, and so we just clicked. Mm-hmm. We just completely clicked and spent many, many hours together. She would read to me, I would read, and she was very firm, and I loved that. She just cut right to it. And that's where we really got along. I love editing and cutting. I love that, especially when you have someone that you completely trust and they can take out, you know, because kind of, she would just give me a certain look and I'm like, cross that out, you know, or go back in and really tell the truth. And one more thing I'll share about her is 20 years earlier about that, I was living with my sister and her roommate. That roommate would tell me, you know, I have to meet my aunt one day. And she lived at that time in England. And he would always talk about her because I was taking writing classes at that time and always taking writing classes. And when I was in that library, she said her name. And I went, wait, is that Zach's aunt? And I went up to her. And so he had planted.
Interesting. Yeah. Lucky to have found her.
Yes, very, very. And she told me I was writing a memoir. And and we went back and forth and I said, I'm definitely not. You know, we took a while. I was like, it's just not, and I have no desire to do that.
Why not?
I talk about it in the book, but I never wanted to be a writer. I've always loved reading. I've loved poetry and admired writers. It just looks so painfully lonely and difficult. And especially, I wanted to be part of a community. You know, theater was interesting to me because it's collaborative.
Right.
And writing just seemed very lonely. And I feel like I had already lived that life through my father growing up. So to live it on my own, I'm like, I don't want to do that again, even though I wasn't writing. And even though I was writing all along.
Yeah. Yeah, it is lonely, right? I mean,
it is.
All the time we have to spend alone, which is, I mean, I like it and that's why I can do it. But I think more extroverted people have a harder time.
Yeah.
Right. Being writers, because it's like, what? I got to be in the office alone. I got to be on a desk alone for hours. Yeah, you do.
Yes. Yes. Right. Right.
Well, let's talk about the beginning of Strip. And maybe before I ask you what I want to ask you, why don't maybe read a few pages? Maybe read from the very beginning.
I will.
All right.
The Lonely Beginning. Victoria, BC. My mom left when I was 2. While I was in her belly and my dad was standing on his head to find a poem, she'd met a sculptor, Paul. After I came out of her belly, she fell in love with him and didn't want him anymore. All I remember is crawling up on the couch, choking on tears, pressing my face and hands to the window, the glass getting cloudy from my breath as I watched her disappear. She didn't see me at the window, but maybe if she had, she would have come back. But she didn't. It's a good thing my dad wanted me. I love him a lot. My mom had another baby, so I have a half-sister, Rilke. But she feels whole to me. She looks just like Paul, her dad. And everyone says I look like my dad, too. I wish I looked like my mom because she is beautiful, but she is moving away with Paul and Rilke to Florida where there are alligators. There's a going away party outside, flowered skirts, bare feet. Rilke steps on broken glass with that little foot of hers. There's too much blood. I put my daisy chain on her ankle. I don't want to tell her I'm not going with her.
Hey, do you want to read the next section too?
Sure. And if anyone was listening and noticed, I said a word wrong. I said that she didn't want Paul, but it was that she didn't want me. So this next chapter, it's the second chapter, it's titled Oysters blackberries in Dad's typewriting. Spring 1975, Mosquito Island. Dad and me are living on a houseboat near Victoria, Mosquito Island. I eat oysters, pick blackberries, and brush my teeth with baking soda. Dad forgot toothpaste. There are no stores, cars, or other people except my friend Isabel, whose parents sail over on their boat. We roll a log from the shore into the water, hold on and kick our feet. We are naked. On the log, we kick, wave our arms, staying steady even when the water gets wavy. Some days I climb the big rocks while Dad writes. If I can't hear the click click of the typewriter, I know I've gone too far. There are foxes and maybe bears in the forest. I don't go into the forest alone, only with my dad. When he comes with me into the forest, he takes my hand into his. I feel so safe. I want to walk with him forever into the forest of sounds, and for him to never let go of my hand. Those are my favorite days. We eat oatmeal, and when Dad rolls up his pants and walks into the water, he catches slimy, pretty oysters and crabs to eat. He lays them on the sand, goes back for more. Sometimes the oysters give us pearls, and I set them on the windowsill. We squeeze lemons for lemonade, pick blackberries in the bushes, come back with purple-stained fingers. Dad is on the shore, cross-legged, with his black journal on his lap, pen in hand. I sit on the edge of the dock, feet in the water, and I have my own journal on my lap. I write in mine every day, just like he does. His eyes are fixed on the clear, gray, blue water. Shades of darkness, ripples, then smooth ripples again. I like night on the houseboat. I lay on the dock. So many stars. The sky gets all glittered up like it's going out dancing.
Thank you. I love that last line. Before we bring Hannah back on, a few words about Patreon. If you've been listening to the show for a while, then you know Patreon is how you can help Marie and me to bring the show to you. If you've gleaned anything from the show that's helped you along your writing path, consider becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/writersonwriting, buying your books at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting also helps us and helps indie bookstores. On our page, you'll find books by authors who've been on the show, as well as books Marie and I recommend. And now for more with Hannah Sword. I noticed, especially listening to you, but I noticed this as I was reading your memoir, that there's lots of granularity. You know, there's so many specific details, so many visuals, so many sensory details where you are, you know, we see it, we can feel the textures, we can smell it. Did that come at first, or was that part of revision of going in and making sure? I mean, I think just about every page is visual, right? For one thing, which is, I think for memoirists, that can be difficult because there's a lot of, especially in first drafts, just getting down sort of the story, which sometimes tends to be more expositional when you're starting out.
Well, the earlier drafts were so different than the way this came out. With doing a pen to paper, it was breathless. That's the word that really, you know, when I look back over it, it was one long, you know, journal of sentences. When I say journals, I like to write in the journals or, you know, those school notebooks, 99 cents. And was the word I loved. and because it was like I just wanted apparently to get it out. And it was hard to tolerate within myself going back to that time. So it was fast. A lot of those details were in there. What I needed to do was cut away. at first I thought maybe the and works, that breathless kind of it, and I ended up, yeah, it doesn't, where it didn't, I didn't think it's not the way I want to go. So a lot of those details were in it, but I did also put a lot of them back in. It was, I mean, to insert them in, and that's for me the most fun part of writing. To go back in, and that's also visualizing it is for me the story. That's the way I can get into a story. Like I'm working on an essay now, and I'm trying to kind of figure out in my head what is this? That just doesn't work for me. I have to go, not have to. When I remember, oh, we're just describing the pouch right now. That's it. And then that will take me somewhere.
Yeah, because some of it, well, a lot of short chapters, right? There's a lot of short chapters, and there's so many scenes or so many even shorter sections that are very impressionistic, you know, which is lovely. And so I was curious, you know, what you're talking about cutting back. I would imagine, I mean, did you have longer chapters, and you know, how did
Oh.
you decide on, you know, I'm going to go short instead of long?
That was very hard. Before I was writing the book, my first love and still my first love is a short story. So I had been working in that form years before. And I think too, growing up with poetry, these clips kind of it's just the way I like to think. And I also love, I love to pick up books and not always start in the front. I just, you know, be at the bookstore and flip through it and see if something pops out. Same with poetry. It's why I love reading poetry so much, because I can just go flip in and go to a page. But I feel like the same with a book, you know? The chapters came as a way of linking it and making it manageable for me. Making it manageable for me. And also, I'm attracted to that because I wanted to clip it along. I wanted it to also speak to readers who don't necessarily read. You know, I don't know if that was conscious, but there was like, okay, if we're in this time of, you know, I wanted it to kind of read like, I mean, there's about, I think, 75 chapters, which is a lot of chapters and 250 pages. And I wanted them really, I mean, I don't know if each of them stands on their own, but I like the idea of these clips that someone could just enter it and read one part.
And did you always begin where you began? I mean, you were very tiny, you're a very tiny person at the beginning of the book, and the voice is also that of a child as you begin. And then as you progress through the book and grow older and to the point where when you end the book, you're an adult. You know, you've been an adult for a while. I mean, but was this always the beginning? Did you always go, you know, I'm going to write it chronologically. I'm going to start.
Definitely, definitely not. No, I had no idea. One of my weaknesses as a writer is structure. And I've always admired writers that can work from structure and outline. And I didn't, even though it's my story, I didn't know the story I wanted to tell. I look at it now and I'm like, oh yeah, it's chronological, it's this, that, but I didn't know what my story was. I also began writing it in a time when I was so unfragmented, if that's a word, within myself. So it was like piecing all these fragments together. So where I began was about, I began in adulthood. It was only going to be adulthood. It was going to be about addiction, stripping, some love. Definitely not childhood. That took, you know, that was Jill's, in one of the writing groups. She said, "I want, you know, you to go home now and start in childhood." And I'm like, well, I'm not going to do that. Yeah, I'm just not. She's like, you are. I'm like, I'm not. I don't want to. It was very, very hard. And yeah, I think I even reverted to a little girl then. So a couple people even pointed out that my mannerisms, like as I would read, would be very little girl-like. And I would wear braids. Like, I mean, part of me wasn't conscious of that. It was like going back into that. I didn't know. And the childhood part was difficult for a lot of reasons. And like I said, I didn't know the story that I wanted to tell or where I wanted to start it from. And a lot of memoirs, as most writers know, I mean, they don't cover the whole, it just covers a very large portion of my life. And that was not my intention.
But it all hangs together. I mean, it's all very, much a part of the story. You're not jumping into scenes that have nothing to do with the overall theme of the book, I don't think. Which is hard, I think, when you're writing memoir. It's like, but I want this to be in it. It's like, but it's not a part of the story, but it's a part of me, but it's not a part of the story. I mean, that's
Exactly. And I mean, I write it up from the time I'm a child until I'm about 39 years old. That's a lot of years. And a lot, I mean, so many years had to be clipped, 5 years had to be 1 year in there. And also what to cut out. I mean, my father was married 5 times. That's a lot of kids. I have 2 siblings in the book, but in reality I have, there's 7 of us. How do I write about my sister in Israel and my other, like it just became chaos. I had to cut them out.
Well, talk about that because I think that that's a really difficult thing to do with memoir. I mean, in fiction, you can make it up, even if you're writing autobiographical fiction or meta fiction. It's you get to make it up, and people don't assume this is, well, at least most readers are not going to assume this is coming from the writer's life. But in memoir, talk about how to decide what to leave out, and why it's okay to do that. Why it's okay not to talk about the other siblings.
I don't know if it's okay. I do know that when I was writing about them and including that, it just became too much. And the story veered off and it became all like just too many characters. And sometimes I wrote a book, will read a book, and I can't follow all the characters. And I'm just, I have to start writing them down so I can track them. And so I did do that. I had these scenes, a lot of scenes about my si other siblings. I think it. These are the two that I grew up with. The other ones were on the real sidelines, and
And
it
it's a different story, right?
it's a different story. Yeah, and it's like, okay, let's narrow in, and the part of the, and I wrote the hardest part for me of writing the book was linking it in the structure. So doing away with things and trying to find where how I link these, that's where I had to really zero in and be like, okay, who are the main people in this, and how do they, hear this often? How does it serve the story? Does it serve the story? It's a very hard decision to make too, because then I have that voice of, oh my God, my sister, Alexis, she's going to be so hurt. She's not in there. Maybe hurt if she was, so I don't know. I don't know. But these things, the fears in my head. Yeah.
What about that? What about the people you write about, and how much are you thinking of them as you're writing and worrying about how they're going to react? Or did you wait until you had a draft and then decide? Or at some point did you let them read it? I mean, how, that's a concern also of memoirs, right? It's like, how
Absolutely.
can I write about them? They're going to be hurt by this.
Yeah. Yes. One of the things that helped is that I didn't know I was writing a memoir, or that I didn't, you know, it wasn't my, I didn't sit down thinking I want to write a book and publish a book. It just wasn't, that wasn't my desire or goal. So that helped. So to get down the raw stuff, right? And also because I was starting in adulthood, I didn't really worry about that. It was more exposing myself, which I had already been writing short stories and doing that. So it, you know, I had that muscle in a sense. When I went back in, that was very hard. Not with my sister, because I knew she, I just assumed she'd be okay with all of it. With what I, you know, because she's with me on a lot of the escapades. My biggest fear, though, was my mother, my father, and my stepmother. And I just couldn't let that get in the way. It just, also the publishing of it and anyone reading of it seems so far away. So far away, you know, even though early on I was working with it and, you know, I had an agent, it still just seemed like, you know, and it was 10 years away. I didn't know it was going to be that long, but it was. And if I'm going to be scared about what I'm writing about them, then I don't have a story. And I didn't let my father read it. He read that maybe I read the first chapter to him, maybe the last chapter. I published a middle chapter that he ended up reading. Some, I guess I forgot to block him on Facebook, and he read it. And that did not go well at all. You know, he was very worried for a number of reasons, you know, about his daughter, me as a daughter, but also, you know, his own reputation, and how that might affect him. And with my mom, she was okay with it all along. She hadn't read any of it, but I remember publishing a piece called My Mother's Men, and somewhat like the chapter in the book called My Mother's Men. And she called and she said, you know, something about, and I'm like, oh no, it's not out, mom. It's not done. It's not published. And I hung up the phone and I thought, okay, I don't have to deal with that. And then I was like, called her back. I said, mom, I just lied to you. It is, but I don't want to hurt your feelings. And she's like, Hannah, it would take 7 books to write about all my men. Not one short story. So that, you know,
yeah.
But it, you know, ultimately it didn't go well when it was published with my mom at all.
What happened?
She was, that first line, as I look at the back of the book in the synopsis, you know, born in the Bohemian 70s, Hannah Sword was abandoned by her mother. Stop right there. It just, yeah, you know, after 6 months, I told my mom I couldn't talk about it anymore. I was done, and we need to move forward. And before it was published too, I sat down with her. I said, mom, I'm scared. My intention was not to hurt you with this. I'm writing it from my point of view as a child.
Right. And a child would feel abandoned with her mother moving, you know,
and that's
miles south.
And she can't, you know, grasp that. So, yeah.
And then did it become okay? I mean, did you, the two of you ever get through that?
No. I will be visiting her next month. I mean, it's not like, you know, we have the best relationship we can have. However, the book's off limits. Like, I was going to do a reading there where she lives. And I just thought, you know what? Why?
Yeah, too close.
To sell some books? No, it's not worth it.
So, I mean, you get so personal, right? I mean, there's a molest scene in the book early on. There's, you're an escort, you're a dancer. It's very personal.
Yes.
So it's interesting to hear you say how you weren't going to write a book. You weren't going to write a memoir.
No.
And then you do. And it's like all of you know, your life is in the book, right?
Yeah.
I would imagine, well, at some point you got over that and you're like, okay, I'm writing the book. I'm going to make it as good as I can make it. But I would think that you also had to change some names or identifying characteristics. I mean, talk about that, like writing this very personal memoir. I mean, all memoirs are personal, but yours is especially personal. And you know, being and disguising people enough that need to maybe be disguised or have their privacy protected.
Yes. Well, all the names in the book are changed, except for one that my sister's ex-mother-in-law was at the reading that I did in New York for the book launch. And she was in the audience and someone asked me that question. Did I change all the names? And I said, yes, all of them, except my father's. And she said, in the middle of the reading, she's this gorgeous, like 6 foot Jamaican woman. She has a presence, right? And in her accent, in her, you know, she said, no, you didn't. You forgot the name to change the name Tuna. Tuna was one of her clients. She had been a dominatrix and she kind of, helped me place an ad. I don't want to give stuff away on that, but I mean, that's ultimately what happened. She helped me. But so I didn't disguise that. I just did the best I could. Some I couldn't. Some I just couldn't. But, you know, for example, there's one man in a hotel room and I talk about seeing him on TV at one of the awards show. And I don't give away who he is. It's not necessary. It doesn't even serve the story.
Right.
Or I do, you know, certain ones I did keep in there. And then the publicist that I had chosen going into it, she had a her insight was you need to change that name because that's a literary darling and that's not gonna,
mm-hmm.
we're not gonna like that. So I did, it was a process. It was a process.
I did wonder who that was then. I'm like, who would that have been? I didn't spend much time on that, but
yeah.
You know, there you go. But so let's talk a little bit about publishing. Because everybody always wants to know about publishing. And
yes.
I read your acknowledgments and you thanked a UK agent. And I'm curious about that, about you
I love
getting.
That you read that. I always read acknowledgments. I'm kind of very, I love it. All the people. Yes, he came about organically. I had sent a book about, I mean, a short story called Stripping. To a literary journal called Erotic Review that had been going on in England at that time, maybe for a couple decades. They were, you know, had a strong standing and I really liked their work. And he emailed back saying he'd like to publish it. And we just started this back and forth. And then he said, are you working on a book? I said, I am. And I didn't know he was an agent. And so we started a dialogue. And a couple years in, no, I sent him different drafts and he didn't sign me right away or anything. It wasn't like that. It was just very organic over a few years. And then in a few years into it, he was very invested. He said, would you like to work together? And I said, well, it looks like we already are, but, and yes. actually it wasn't a hard yes, because I was kind of like, well, maybe might be better to have a US agent. So I did look with that. I talked to some agents here and it just, I mean, he was a natural fit.
And then Tortoise Books, what was that like working with them and working with an editor? And how much did you do with him before it then went to a publisher?
I had done a lot on my own. With the publisher or with the editor from Tortoise, it was probably most, a lot of it was grammar or and punctuation. I'm still confused about that. I remember taking a class on it and I got more confused and that really messed me up. Even the teacher was like, "What? How did you write up?" And then he's like, "I'm like, I don't know." He's like, "I have to give you a B. You can't get an A." And I'm like, "Okay." I don't know. So he did a lot of that, and also a lot of the timeline of, referring to, the little things. Like I had a car in 89, and then I had the same car in 2002, which made no sense. I mean, it
It
could,
could.
but not the way I was describing it would be. So things like that, which are so helpful. With Tortoise, that was, it was been, the publishing world was, the publishing process was as long as writing it for me. I did have an offer early on from a small press, and I'm someone that does, I did my research. I really, when I hear, I didn't, for whatever reason, jump on it. I wanted to talk to the authors. It's already taken this long. And where am I going with it? And then I also always saw it as a small book with just a small audience. I didn't really ever see it up like with a big publisher. But I did at one point try for that, especially with the agents. And then I had a New York agent. And it came to a point, Barbara, where I really had to ask myself, where do I want to spend my time? That's really what it came down to. What do I And the agent process, I after the New York agent, I'm like, I can't, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to look for another agent, a third agent, which I do have a third agent now, and that's, for the audio rights and that, I need another one now. Just believe, I know people are get really excited about agents, but it also doesn't mean like, okay, now it's gonna happen. But part of me, it's questions if that was the right thing to do. I don't know. Because there was a lot of, by the time I was sending out an updated query and then the manuscript, I was finally got a query that was, I put in the query what needed to be, which was some of the praise from the blurb I had. I don't know why I wasn't including that. And I got a good response, but then I just was like, So Tortoise, I took about a year to make the decision with the tortoise.
It sounds like you have a lot of patience.
I mean, I'm making myself sound that way, but I really don't. I did in that process. It just for some, it was hard. It was really hard. I lost faith over and over and over again, and really, really that internal work of what's my primary, like, why am I doing this? What do I want? And the validation of being with a big five and having an agent, a lot of that was ego for me. And also, of course, wanting as many readers as possible. But where do I want to put my time ultimately in finding another agent, in writing another proposal? I wanted to start writing again.
All the business stuff that used to be writers just needed to write. That's all they needed
Yeah.
to do. And now marketing and promo and social media, it's like you spend half your time writing and half your time doing all that. And
Yeah.
I mean, not all writers do, but most of us have to, right? I mean, it's expected now.
Yes. Yes. And, I think that, from my friends that do have the bigger publishers, it does seem like it gives you more access. It is difficult being with a small press, and but at the same time, thank God they're there. And they, I think I know I chose Tortoise because he completely believed in the book, and he got my voice.
And small presses, more and more, I have such respect and love for them because also with a small press, writers often get more attention. I mean, you still have to do promo and everything else, but there's, you reach out And it's not that hard to talk to the publisher or to the editor. You know, it's like they're right there. They get back to you right away. It's not a week later, 2 weeks later.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. And one of the things I go back to over and over is the relationships that that I don't know if I would have had if I went if Strip had been in the big five, because so much of this has been footwork, mm-hmm. including meeting you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, it's all been this organic, you know, some authors have reached out to me recently saying, how are you doing all these? And I'm not someone who's pitched a lot. It just doesn't seem to, you know, however, it's by meeting in a community, and ultimately that's the nourishing part.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I look at the numbers for sales and I go there and I'm like, that's, what am I doing looking at those numbers? What do they fill?
Right.
I want them to feel something, but they just, you know, I keep thinking they will. I keep thinking, Barbara, they will. I'll be like, it will fix me. I'll feel so good. And I can, you know, run around and be free, or I don't know what my idea is.
What are you working on? I mean, do you see yourself doing another memoir, or are you working on fiction, or what are you doing?
Short stories. I'm back to short stories. I have a collection, and one of the authors I met you through actually offered to read it. And I'm the worst. I don't ask people to read my works. I think it's a huge ask.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really big ask. And also I need to trust them implicitly, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I need to know where are they coming from? What kind of work do they like? But in any case, yes, so I do have a short story collection. That's where I am right now. And also essays, which I don't think of myself really as an essayist, but I've been writing some articles, which have really surprised me, where I'm like, didn't know I had a desire to do that. And part of me, yeah, anyway, so it's I like to challenge myself too with those, with articles and essays. They're very different. I was working on one recently with the Huffington Post, and it was, you know, it's not my natural state. It took a lot to draw out of drafts. He even said, thanks so much for your hard work on this. I'm like, no, thank you. It just doesn't come to me.
Right. Well, you had a big piece in the LA Times a couple of months ago.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for remembering. Yes, yes. And that was complete surprise. I mean, I had never submitted something to them. I never thought about it. It was just a complete, like, I don't even know how that happened.
Well, did you find that, did you have any way to track how many readers or how many books you sold after that?
I didn't. I got a lot of emails, some nice, some not. You know, I wanted to share one of them, and I put it in the story, and then I was like, I'm not posting it to get feedback of, no, it is good. I'm like, no, I just want to share that.
Right.
I found it really amusing. This person said, stop writing immediately. But no, that's not entirely, I don't think it sold that many books more.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't, I did see that it raised, the website, and also it feels like the sales have, you know, they're not at zero, so that's good. They're not at zero, and also it's just, you know, it was fun, especially because it was so unexpected. Those things happen when,
yeah.
You know, I had been in a phase of hating writing. I absolutely mm-hmm. was hating it, and shared it on Facebook. I hate it. Why? I don't even know why I'm doing it anymore. And then I wrote that piece, not for the LA Times, but just for, you know, one night, and it came, and someone said, well, you should send it there. So it was, yeah, that was really, really great and experience and fun. And it kind of opened the door of, oh, you mean newspapers publish stuff like this? they'll publish something about meth, you know? Weird.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, you know, in terms of book sales, because I even hear from agents that book reviews in prominent places don't really even sell books. the way word of mouth does. I mean, word of mouth is apparently the major way that books are being sold. I mean, book clubs, of course, and that's something that we have now that we didn't have some years back, but that book reviews, you can't really even depend on those anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I mean, I certainly word of mouth has been the case with Strip, and the community has been, you know, I've had a, I mean, when I'm in a place of spiritually fit and getting to look at it in that way, I'm like, I'm very fortunate, you know.
You're also really active on social media. Well, at least on Instagram, I see you. And I'm not very active on anything but Instagram at the moment, Substack and Instagram. But so tell me about that in terms of, like, you know, social media and you. Like, what's your relationship with it? And what does it do for you?
It really messes me up. It really does. And I was not on Instagram until a couple months before the book came out, which is, I was just not open to it. Mm-hmm. I just didn't care. Then I started caring and I realized, oh, it is a community. It was very difficult because my father had passed around the time when, you know, right before the pretty, you know, month, some months before the book came out. So I had a friend that I just said, I'm going to hire you just to do the basics. Just do, I don't know what that is. Do one of the stories, or I didn't even know the terminology a year and a half ago. So it's been a learning curve and it's been really challenging because it's not natural for me at all. And when I hear you say that, I'm act on it and I just laugh because I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I will, you know, there's so many things I haven't shared because I'm like, how do I share this? And you know, people are like, capitalize on your content. And I'm like, I definitely have some content I could put in there, but I don't know how to put it in there. And so, like, I did, you know, like different things where I'm like, okay, I'll video it from my phone on the computer to the computer and then post it, you know, and it's just, you can see, you know, it's doesn't come natural. And I don't know how many books that sells, to be honest, but it does create a community.
Right.
It's certainly where I've, you know, I've been very fortunate with the podcasts. I haven't, you know, they've all come organically, I think, from that, mm-hmm. from talking about things and supporting other writers, you know. I love posting other people's books and it's exciting to say, my God, you know, this is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And to say so-and-so has a launch day. And so in that sense, I, you know, if I had the money, I'd just like to hire someone just to say, go do that.
Right. Yeah.
I don't like it. I really don't. And I don't know how much of an impact it makes.
Mm.
But I think it all is about putting out that energy and you know, it's impossible to do it in the void.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's, you know, I've learned so much. I mean, I didn't even know, and I feel embarrassed. Well, I'm starting this sentence, but like, I didn't know how important pre-orders were.
Right.
Like, I just had no clue.
Well, talk about that. Say a few words about that, because I think that's probably surprising to a lot of listeners. We always see, you know, pre-order now and it'll be out a month from now. And you go, well, why don't I wait till it comes out? Right.
And that was my attitude with my own book. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know, which is strange, you know, especially growing up in a, you know, household of writing, but poetry is very different. There's pre-orders. It's like pre-orders. Mm-hmm. People already read poetry. So let's just, I mean, that's not true, but it was just, you know, it's also a very different time at that time. But sales wasn't the primary purpose. Yeah, I just didn't know. So I can't even, I don't even know if I had any pre-orders. I didn't make, I don't think, I made maybe one post of saying, You can pre-order.
Right.
So, I don't, I've also been very fortunate where I have, gotten notice that the book's in bookstores. I wouldn't know unless, maybe other authors have this experience, unless someone's like, oh, I was in such and such in that city or, but in going forward, I would pay attention to that. I would. And I mean, I didn't look at any of the numbers. I didn't know about that. Like, looking on Amazon, numbers. I just didn't know any of this, which seems
Yeah,
very
I'm
funny.
curious. I need to find out too, like with pre-orders. I know that pre-orders will influence how many books are printed, but I wonder if it's a percentage. Like if you get X number of pre-orders, then we're gonna have X number of books printed. I mean, they're not just printed based on pre-orders, but I think the number of pre-orders tells the publisher how many to print, right? Something like that.
That could well be what I feel like I got that number before. I don't remember exactly. My understanding, and I'm sure you know much more than I do in this area, it informs the booksellers, the bookstores, of what's moving. That's my understanding. I could be wrong. That's why I was surprised when my book was in stores and the reviews. That's where the trade reviews, again, from my understanding, are important. Like Kirkus did not give my book a good review, and I think that influenced the libraries. I mean, book strip is in 60 libraries. I think that surprises me that that even happened. But there's a lot of libraries, so I don't have something to compare it to. But I certainly don't think that review helped. And then Booklist gave it an incredible review. you got to kind of, but pre-orders, I think they, I would do it differently going forward.
Well, in terms of reviews, getting one great review and one not so great review, it's kind of like looking for an agent, right? Like, one agent says, not for me, not working. And another agent says, oh, this is exactly what I've been looking for. And you just go, oh my gosh, what, how do you figure this out? Right. You just have to keep going.
And that's really helpful. Like I love reading about and listening to, it's one of the reasons I love your podcast so much. I love that it's so important and nourishing to listen to other people's journeys. And I'm just like, it's just, we all have such a different journey, and getting to share that. And yes, with the agents, even within the same agency, I lost track of how many I was sending out. Like it was 100 before I even got one reply. I definitely have my father's, like my mom called my mom, my dad, like she called him like the king of rejection. And I have that definitely where I'm like, I can handle it. I mean, also that could be, that I could be crying after this, getting an email. So I should watch what I say, but in terms of putting it out there,
right.
And with the agents, I lost track of who I was sending it to. And I remember sending it to one large agency, and immediately like, no, not what we're looking for. And I guess at some point I had sent it to, someone else, and it was the head of the agency, and she said, I want to see it immediately. So it just shows, like,
right,
just what you said.
Well, we have a few minutes left, and I just have a couple more things. And one is, who are your influences? Apart from your father, apart from Jill, like, who do you read? What have you read lately, even, that you've loved?
Well, right now I'm reading an author. She had sent me her book called Craving Spring. So she's, and it's just a really wonderful book. I tend to read up until this past year, because I've met so many writers that it's like, I mean, I feel I have to read their books. And I'm a slow reader. I really, there's so many for lack of a, so many dead writers I haven't read. So yeah, I most recently read Ivan, I forget, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. But the Russian writers, the French writers, I really love, and also I love Bukowski because he gives me permission to, he helps me write. He helps me come to the page like, oh, I can just write about my day. And I, whether or not that's what's, just it, I like reading writers that give me freedom to do what I want to do. And also writers that are very different, than myself, like Isaac Bashevis, Isaac Bashevis, I don't know how to pronounce his name, I should, my mom's going to kill me, Bashevis Singer. I mean, I read
Right,
my,
okay.
I just finished a book of his, Gimple and the Old Fool, I think it's called, and oh my God, it's like, I'm like, his short stories, I just, completely different than my kind of writing, and I'm just in awe, and it's just, beautiful, so beautiful. And oh my God, what's, I want to find the other one with the Russian author, Ivan something, anyway.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, but his last name is not coming to me either.
Yeah, I could see it spelled Yabashinko. I don't know. Don't know, but yeah, so those are the two latest books I read that I just that I loved. And I'm actually reading also a newer book. I mean, she's passed since, but Lucia Berlin, who
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't heard of.
Yeah.
And I just opened up her book and I'm like, there's so many incredible authors.
Yeah, so many, so many. I wish I could just have like not sleep and be able to use that time reading, right?
Yes, and then I'd see yours, Palm Springs Noir, where I'm like, wait, how did I like yeah. And that's been actually the hardest part, is having a book out, is meeting all the writers and just being like, wanting to support all of them, read their books, write a review, and I'm just such a slow reader too. So what are you reading?
What am I reading? I am reading, I'm reading Last Acts by Alexander Sammartino. He's going to be on the show. And it's a novel that takes place in Phoenix. So I don't
In
know
your
how I,
desert,
yeah,
yeah.
I love the
I
desert.
remember you asking that about to Melissa, or saying on the interview,
Yeah, love the
yeah,
desert.
about Death Valley, yeah.
So I'm reading that, and I'm also, there's something else that I started reading. What is it though? I mean, I usually have like books all over the place that I'm reading, and but that one I have to finish. Oh, you know what I'm reading? I'm reading one that's coming out called Watch Her by somebody. I don't even remember the last name yet, but I'm gonna interview her for the show too. I think it's an LA writer who's writing Irish fiction. So that's kind of interesting to me.
And who inspires your own writing? I mean, that's such a huge question, but.
Who inspires it?
Or, I mean, not even inspired, like, who are some of your idols, a couple of your
Oh,
idols?
my idols, Patricia Highsmith, Dorothy Hughes, older noir writers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, what I just read that I loved for, I think I read it three or four times before, The Great Gatsby. The writing is just incredible. I mean, it's dated in some ways, but so many beautiful sentences. So
Yes.
I agree when you said, you know, all the dead authors, all the dead writers. It's like I'm usually writing or reading a dead author, right? You know, it's like I can't talk to them on the show. But I can read them, you know.
One of my favorite books, and I read it when I was 19, and it still always stayed with me, was Journal of a Solitude, May Sarden. Just
You know, I've never read Journal of Solitude. I've been aware of Mae Sarton forever, and I have never read that book, which I should. It's a memoir.
her gardening, and I hate gardening, but just
Well, Hannah, tell me any little tips you have for the memoirists that are listening. Any words of wisdom for the writers, working their way through a memoir?
I couldn't have done it if I wasn't writing every day. And it didn't matter what I was writing. Sometimes it was about the day. It had nothing to do with the memoir, but keeping the pen moving. I'm very big on that. And I started the book by, without knowing it was a book, with 5 minutes a day. And I think all of those things add up. And those 5 minutes a day ended up being 2 pages handwritten fast. I mean, it sounds so but just to keep going. I mean, there was so many times I just thought, I can't do this. Like when I got the first draft back from the agent and he said, I want you to read a book on structure. So I'm like, I can't, this is, no, I can't do it. And it happens, it unfolds, it reveals itself.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I'm writing every day. I mean, I think yesterday I didn't want to, I don't know, I needed to get back to my project. I'm like, oh, but I have to go do this. I'm like, just sit down and write this scene. And once I did, I had 500 words. And I was able to go on and do other things I really needed to do yesterday. I had a class that I had to prepare for and different things, but yeah.
The scene. That's the single most thing too. I was working on a new essay and I was just for the rumpus, and I've just been, I have to get this in. And I've just been resistant, even, sweat my floor. And finally, I'm like, just a scene. So that's a really helpful thing. And then a writer's group. I can't imagine without my writer's group. Getting to hear out loud and getting that feedback. Tricky. Got to find the right people, but.
I so appreciate you taking the time, and I just wish you continued luck with Strip and everything else you're working on.
Barbara, thank you so much. And likewise with with all of yours, and just thank you for all you do for the writing community, bringing so many writers together and on. And again, it's an honor.
Thank you. That was Hannah Sword, author of Strip, a memoir. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen, and a huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who help make this show possible. I have a Substack page called Pen on Fire where I talk about writing and do interviews with authors and agents, many of whom have been on the show. Thank you, Travis Barrett, for your music and sound editing. And if you like the music you hear on the show, you can find more typewriter music on Spotify under the artist Just My Type. Travis also has original music on Spotify under his name, Travis Barrett. You can access our archive of shows, thousands by now, at writersonwriting.com. If you want to get in touch, email writersonwritingpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach Travis Barrett at travisbarrettcreative@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. And in the meantime, stay in the chair.